March 22nd, 2017. Masoret. I wanted to take up Rashi's pshat with regard to the construction of the kior, which is the basin. And you can see that just the way the Torah describes it, that there's something different about this object in terms of the donations of the material that was used. So that's... yesterday, I'd say we dealt with more of the plain shot, which itself was interesting because it points out who were the ones that came forth to donate, and essentially that it was the women. There was some kind of a an outpouring, so to speak, from a certain category of women. And it had to do with the fact that they donated their mirrors. So already that led to that whole discussion as to why they would do that, and then the significance of the mirrors and what it represents. Now we're going to take up Rashi. And Rashi is more along the lines of a Midrashic approach. So let's see what he has to say. So again, the psukim Vayas es hakior, the last person mentioned in terms of the design and the sculpting of the objects is Bezalel. So he wasn't the only one, but it would appear that it's either referring to him or one of the he oversaw the work that was done by the others who had these skills, the artisans. Because it goes back to the beginning of lines of Lamed Zayin, chapter where it says Vayas Bezalel. Because this portion takes up, the structuring, the construction. And so it says he made the Aron, and he describes the fact that, it's pretty obvious that he did it in accordance with the instructions that he had received. Now, all the subsequent, then comes the Shulchan, the four vessels, so to speak, that the Truma had begun with, then the table. Now, it doesn't say who made the table, it just says he. So I assume it's a continuation, and it's referring to Bezalel. Then after that is described, going back to verse 17, then he made the menorah. So again, it's probably Bezalel. And then on verse 25, he made the incense, the mizbeach, the altar of incense. And then the altar for the Ola offering, that's on beginning of chapter 38. And that brings us to verse 8, where he takes up the kior. It says that he made the kior, okay, of and the base with the base of copper. So with the mirrors. Okay, it's not an easy pasuk to translate. Bamaros, so Bamaros is the mirrors. Okay. Hatsovos. Now, who are the Tsovos? So, Unkelus translates it as the Neshaya, the women, the Usyan, Litzalah, Bisra, the women who congregated. So So he translates that the mirrors of the women who congregated at the Pesach, at the door or the opening of the Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting. So that itself is very intriguing. All of a sudden, there's a group of women who've congregated to give the mirrors. So that does lead, that does pique the curiosity. So let's take Rashi. So Rashi says, with the mirrors of the women who congregated. So he says, Benos Yisrael, hayu biyadan maros. The daughters of Israel had in their possession copper mirrors. Sheroas behen kashen miskashtos, which they would look into when they would beautify themselves. Okay, so we discussed that yesterday. That's a normal thing, you know, a cosmetics bag, whatever. Every woman, generally speaking, goes around and has her mirror with her. Okay, fine. So he says, but then Rashi says, V'yaf osan lo ikvu, milhavi l'nidvas ha-mishkan. Even those mirrors, they did not withhold from bringing for the contribution towards the Mishkan. Now here's where it gets interesting. V'hoya mois Moshe behen b'bnei shasuyim l'yetzahara. But Moshe, mois, disliked them, rejected them because they were made for the, you know, the Yetzirah. They reflected the Yetzirah. Okay. Not that there's anything evil. I mean, it's hard to say what's evil about that. But essentially, it's going off into a different realm. It had to do with the vanity and sensuality and so on and so forth. So it's interesting because it depicts almost a machlokas here. The way Rashi is describing it, there was a, if you will, a machlokas between Moshe. Moshe's immediate reaction was that these should not be accepted as legitimate for the construction of the Mishkan. And I guess if, at first glance you can see his position. However, Amalo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but God said to him, this is interesting, Kabel, accept them. Ki elu chavivin alai min akol. Because these are chaviv, more beloved to me than anything else, and then all the other objects. Shal yedein hamidu hanoshim tzvos, tzvos rabos b'mitzrayim. Okay. For by means of them, the women established many legions of offspring in Egypt. So they have a very interesting history, the mirrors. What is that? Kishahayu balei and yegeim bavodas ferach. When their husbands would be exhausted by the backbreaking labor, you know, that the Egyptians imposed on them. It's a very interesting story. Probably heard it before. So you have a situation where the men were kind of like completely exhausted physically, but I don't think it's a stretch to say that their whole attitude was that it's pretty much hopeless. In other words, they didn't want to get together with their wives because they didn't want to have children. Okay, so it says, Hayu holchos umolichos lahem machol mishta. So the women would go out into the fields and bring them food and drink. Okay, and they would, you know, feed them. Then it says, Venotlos hamaros. Then they would take the mirrors. And each one would view herself with her husband in the mirror. I guess play, you get the sense that they would sort of play games. Umeshadalto bedvarim, and would entice him with words, saying, "Ani noam imcha, I'm better looking than you." In other words, they would kind of, you get the sense that the men were reluctant. They were just exhausted, and they weren't interested. And the women went out of their way to create a certain arousal or desire using these mirrors. By these means, they would bring their husbands to desire, and would have relations with them, and they would conceive and give birth there. Interesting, because it mentions that they gave birth there, as it says, "Tachas ha-tapuach orarticha," quotes a pasuk which says, "Under the apple tree I aroused you." Okay, so this is a very fascinating kind of a story. It's not the typical story. I don't know about, in the yeshivas they teach all the Rashis. I don't know about this one. I doubt that they teach this Rashi. I don't know when any of you may have heard it the first time. I doubt if it would be in yeshiva.
But I heard it in a class, the rabbi.
In a class?
Another rabbi.
Okay. Well, when was that, though? When you were an adult?
It was years ago, but I was an adult.
Yeah. Okay, I understand it. I don't know. I'm not saying that you teach it to little kids. But I don't know about teenagers, whether they would teach it to teenagers or not. And that's not my point. But it's a very fascinating, because it's completely out of character. It's totally out of character. I would be interested in hearing, what his approach was and what this rabbi, I don't need to know who he is or whatever, but just curious as to how he taught it and what the point was that he was making. But let's just proceed. It's very, very fascinating. As I said, I think it's completely out of character, because you don't expect to hear this. You don't, you expect to hear about the righteous women, in Egypt, and all the great things they did and how they made sacrifice. That's the kind of things you expect to hear. And you expect to hear about the tremendous level of tzinius. That's usually, modesty and the foregoing of pleasure. And certainly this kind of behavior is very, very strange. Not that there's anything intrinsically wrong with it. It's just very bold. It's not depicting women in the way that, like Vasara Hine Ba'ohala, that Sarah was in the tent. The idea that women are supposed to be in the tent and men pursue the women and so on and so forth. Here it's the exact opposite. They're sort of going outside the tent and they're pursuing the men. And not only that, the men are reluctant. I guess that's understandable because of the situation. But the women then have to, playing games to arouse the men. That part of it is, generally speaking, would seem to be unusual. So it happened. But it's not the kind of thing you want to talk about in polite company. So that's the maros. That's the maros. Those are the mirrors. Then Rashi gets back to the point over here. This is what is meant by that which is said with the mirrors of those who congregated. So now what's the connection with the kior, with the basin? The kior was made of them. So Rashi depicts a specific type of a connection. Shehu lasum shalom beinish liishto. Because the purpose of the kior, and one of the purposes, is to establish peace between a man and his wife. Lahashkos bimayim shebesocho lemisha kine lo bala. This gets back to the whole case of Sota, which we discussed. And we said that the essential concept behind the institution of Sota has to do with shalom, that the name of God even is erased in order to establish peace between a man and his wife. So the kior was used for that purpose. That's where the water came from, and that's the water that eventually she would drink. Vinistera, a woman who had been accused by her man, warned not to be together with a certain individual, and nevertheless she had seclusion with him. So this is So then she's subjected to the drinking of the water. They, so v'teidalacha shehein maros mamash, and you should know for sure that they are mirrors. Shenemar nechoshes atenufa shivim kikar, etc. For it says, and the copper of the offering was 70 kikar, and so on. All right, whatever. It goes on to, I don't know, to work it out that the copper of the kior was not the same as the copper of the offering. Because there were different coppers that were donated, but Rashi wants to prove that they were from the copper of the mirrors. Okay. So then he brings other proofs. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. That's the main point. So the question is, what? It seems that there's a big gap between the position of Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu said that not to include the, his position was not to include the mirrors, the use of the mirrors in the construction of the Mishkan. And it's not just that God disagreed and overruled him, but God is seems to be taking it to the other extreme by saying that, to the contrary, not only is it acceptable, that these are more precious than anything else. So my question is, what's the underlying idea over here? Okay, it's a nice little story, but what's the idea? Why, let's start off with the position of Moshe. Why would it be rejected? And then, of course, we'll try and see the other side. Let's try and explain the negative side first. That when we think of the Mishkan, you know, we're thinking of something which is holy. And I suppose, that the idea is that the holy is that which is, you know, separated, is elevated from the profane or the mundane, but basically from the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is an expression of a different dimension of man. The fact of the matter is that man is a physical being, and as such he has physical needs and physical desires. However, we generally regard those as being, you know, that doesn't express his essence. It doesn't express his true nature, or, you know, the highest side of him. So the Mishkan is supposed to be, you know, you leave your sensuality behind. Sensuality is part of life, but it's not part of the Mishkan. The Mishkan is to be elevated above and beyond that. So you don't bring in something which would reflect the Yetzer Hara, because you don't want to give it any credence, so to speak. Or you certainly don't want to elevate it, which is a significant point. I mean, that's the big battle. That's the big battle that Judaism is waging in every generation. What is the essence of man? And what's the purpose of life? Does it lie within the realm of pleasure, you know, to obtain more and more? Oops. Hello?
Welcome. This service is provided by Freecon. You entered 3588. There is one other participant in this conference.
Hello?
Please announce yourself.
Hello? I got cut off. Hello?
Hello,
we're
here.
Who's here? Hello? You better be back?
Yeah.
All right, and I just got cut off somehow. Okay. Now, I was saying, I was expounding on that idea that you've mentioned, and that is that the Mishkan should not include those aspects of life which are sensual, which essentially take a person away from the higher activities, so to speak. So, according to that view, so Moshe rejected it. He did not want to glorify the physical, the sensual. And as I was saying, that the Judaism is constantly fighting that battle. It's not just a battle against overt avodah zarah and idolatry, but today the prevailing idea in the culture is really a sensual one, a sensual idea. Of course, the ultimate purpose that each person is striving for is to obtain a certain type of a gratification. I mean, it's not specifically sexual. There's other things as well, but it's kind of oriented in that. You could see that that's the pleasure, the basic goal of the society, the philosophy of life, really centers around pleasure. That's why, you know, today, you know, the attitudes have changed tremendously in terms of all different types, you know, gay, transsexual, this sexual. In other words, nobody has the right to say that this is legitimate and that's not legitimate. Because whatever gives a person gratification, that's, what he's entitled to it. You can't come out against it. Because if that's the orientation, that is that the whole purpose of life is really to fulfill yourself in that manner. So you can't stop another person from doing that. Okay. So for all these reasons, I mean, and Judaism, of course, is totally against that. That the ultimate purpose of life is not the sensual pleasure. But that has a place, but it has to be something which is restrained and then controlled and so on and so forth. Not all forms of gratification are legitimate because that's what gratifies you. Okay. So that's, I assume, for all these reasons, so that's the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is something, the evil inclination, has to be kept out. It has to be kept out of the Mishkan. So if that's the case, what's the other point of view? And that Rashi talks about apparently didn't behave modestly. There's a time and a place for everything. Even immodest behavior has a redeeming quality to it. One is criticizing the women for what they did because it was in the service of God. There are instances, which we're not going to go into now, it's a very fascinating topic, of women who did perform, well, this wasn't what they did in Mitzrayim, wasn't the Navera, it was their husbands. It's just the manner in which they went about it was unusual. Okay, fine. And it's easier to understand. However, there are cases of women that went further than this. And they're defended by Chazal with the concept of the Avera for the sake of a mitzvah. That's, for example, the case of Yael. According to Chazal, the way they interpret the story, who enticed Sisera, you know, the evil, general of Yavin, Melech Kenan, who was a big enemy of the Jews, and she was instrumental in, well, actually, she killed him. She enticed him into the tent. Her goal was to cause him to fall asleep. And when he was asleep, she killed him. I mean, she took the peg of the tent and drove it through his temple. But in order to do so, she had to entice him, and she gave him milk to drink, but I do believe that the Chazal say that she had relations with him. That was an Avera, but it was for the sake of the mitzvah, and when Devorah constructs the Shira of praise, she praises Yael, that she's blessed from the women. So Chazal go that far as to acknowledge that, I'm not getting into the whole halachic issue, but there is a concept of an avera l'shem mitzvah. You have it in the Chumash as well. In the case of Tamar, the daughter-in-law of Yehuda, that, well, that comes up. The fact that she conspired and deceived him, pretending that she was a prostitute and so forth, but it was all a shame. It was for the sake of the mitzvah, because she wanted to have, you know, the children, who would be significant in terms of the future of Klal Yisrael. So it does have that concept. And this, however, is not that controversial, because there's no aveira over here. To the contrary, it's a mitzvah for the sake of mitzvah. Nevertheless, okay, fine. We can recognize that. Nobody's challenging. I don't think anyone's challenging that or seeks to wonder why could they do a thing like that. To the contrary, it's something which we would acknowledge as being heroic. But how does it find its way into a discussion as to whether mirrors should be brought into the Mishkan? That is, you could have that discussion separately. And I think most people would say, would, you know, applaud, approve of what the women did. But it carries over now into a discussion about mirrors, because mirrors played a role in that. It's funny. It's funny how it gives you that particular detail, that they used the mirrors to entice the men. So the mirror was an instrument of enticement. So now the mirror, that's clear. That's what Moshe said. It's an instrument of enticement. It reflects the Yetzer Hara. So very nice story. But you don't build a Mishkan out of that. There's two ways you could look at Kedusha. I think there are two ways. The first way is basically a completely separate realm. I'm not attributing this to Moshe Rabbeinu, but I'm just looking at people in general. In general, people have the holy. People look at the holy as being something which is, beyond human. It's like an otherworldly experience. And not just Jews, but people in general. It's like, it's very hard for people to define what exactly is the holy. But the holy is a different realm. It's a mystical, it's a wholly, completely different realm. Like angels, not human. It's not, you can't trespass over there. It's sort of, I guess, the term would be to transcend. Transcend. And, you know, that attitude sort of looks down upon the ordinary, the human, man's physical nature. It's there, but we sort of don't talk about it. You know, it's not something to be proud of, so to speak. But when you enter into the holy, it's like a different realm. And people have a certain feeling of awe about the holy. But that's not the idea, apparently. According to that, so you want to separate. It's real separation. You want to separate the holy from anything that has to do with what we call the ordinary, the mundane. Now, certainly, those things which reflect man's... So man is, so to speak, two-dimensional. He's got this dimension in which he can remove himself and enter into this world of, something beyond. And then, of course, he's involved. He has no choice. He's involved in matters of the flesh. To me, that attitude sort of reflects the Christian. Because the Christian attitude towards the physical is disparaging. That is, that it's there. You have no choice. For example, like sexual indulgence, in and of itself is bad or evil, whatever term they want to apply to it. But, I mean, theoretically anyways, what can you do? You have to have children. So you have to engage in something which is evil because you have no choice. Theoretically, one should not have sexual relations unless it's for procreation. That's not the attitude of Judaism, though. That's not the attitude of Judaism. The attitude of Judaism, to the contrary, if you go through the Rambam, where he talks about that in every area of life, there's a purpose. All of the various physical, sensual, if you want to take this concept that everything has the capacity to enter into the realm of the holy, you could fit that into the Rambam in Deos. I don't know if he uses the word holy, but he says it becomes a service of God. B'chol derachecho de'ehu. In all of your paths, you should acknowledge God, recognize God. In other words, all of this is subsumed under the heading of the service of God. That is, to service of God is not just when you're doing the mitzvah. It's any activity that is necessary for man's sustenance, for man's existence. If he undertakes that activity with the proper approach, that is, it's not an end in itself, whether it be earning money, whether eating food, to eat the proper foods, avoid the improper ones, for the sake of keeping his body in the best possible condition. So then that and not just for the sake of health, though. I mean, there's a lot of people today that are like completely, you know, submerged in the, in the world of just the health and nutrition and so forth, but it doesn't really have a higher purpose. So that's not the service of God. But if it does have a higher purpose, that the reason why he maintains himself in a certain condition is so that he should be in the best possible position to serve God properly, so then all these activities become a service of God. And he says even when he's sleeping, that is, if a person sets aside the amount of time that he needs, doesn't just, you know, go to sleep when he's exhausted and he just sleeps as long as his body demands, but rather it's a plan, it's part of a plan. Then all these activities, now the same thing is true with sexual, that sexual activity, sexual relationships can be a service of God. If it fits into that pattern, that he's living a lifestyle which is based upon the principle of in all your ways, acknowledge him, recognize God. So he says the same thing. If a person engages in sexual relations, obviously he doesn't have to say that with someone who's permitted to him. That's not, he doesn't even mention it because that's assumed. But what's his purpose? If his purpose is essentially for maintaining the health of the body and the psyche and for procreation, which is for the appropriate person, that he'll raise a child and that child will serve God. So then that activity is also subsumed, becomes a service of God. So according to this, there's no differentiation. You can't say that, true, you have the good, we use the expressions of the good inclination and the bad inclination, but Chazal say that you should serve God with your evil inclination. Say the Chazal say you should serve God with your good inclination. It's just inclinations. And in and of themselves, they're neither good nor bad. It all depends upon the uses that man puts them to. So therefore, he could serve God with the evil inclination. And he could have, but to the contrary, he can act in accordance with his good inclination and it's not a service of God. For example, misdirected compassion. You know, Rachmanis is a good thing, but if it's directed towards Rishayim, so it's a bad thing. So that's a completely different attitude. There's no such thing then, this differentiation. Now here's a situation with the mirrors, where precisely, which shows it in a stark manner, because it took mirrors and vanity, it's a tool of human vanity, and they used it in the sexual. And I mean, the whole story, as I said, is pretty much out of character for Rashi's. Rashi's, you know, they don't just bring it down. Those kinds of stories, you know, the playing of games, and I'm prettier than you, and this and that, just to get the men aroused. So one would think emotionally, okay, fine, but that's not, we don't want to publicize that. But Hashem said no. That's the concept of Kedusha. That is the concept of Kedusha that the Mishkan should reflect. That is to say, the Kedusha which comes about as a result of utilizing everything that Hashem created in the proper manner. That's a higher level. See, the pathway of repression is to get it out, is to, and that's a pathway that many people choose. That is to simply repress something because it's dangerous. Yeah, the Yetzer Hara is dangerous. sensuality is dangerous. So let's just repress it. And then we just push it out of our lives. Okay, so now we're holy. We're disconnected from the Yetzer Hara. So that, should that be the ideal? The fact that we're disconnected from it? I'm not saying what Moshe, because I don't want to attribute the other view to Moshe. Let's hold off on Moshe's idea. We'll just focus now on what the Hashem said. But Hashem said that is the concept of Kedusha, is to engage with it, to utilize it for the purpose of achieving the proper result. That is, in this situation, there was a danger that the nation would not be perpetuated, and it required, what was required over here was precisely the Yetzer Hara. To lose your modesty, in other words, it shouldn't be a false modesty. That's a false emotional modesty. In other words, women that could not act that way. If the women at that time recognized the problem, and they saw that, they understood that the men simply were in no condition, were in no mood for that, and then someone came up with this idea, well, use the mirrors, the games, and so on, and they said, oh, we can't do that. If the woman said, we can't do that, we can't be immodest, then that would have been the wrong thing. They would not have been true servants of God. The true servant of God is one who arranges, doesn't have any of these emotional absolutes. It's not an emotional absolute. It's a rational absolute. The emotional absolute of modesty would have said, we can't do it. But they were able to do it. To the contrary, because they didn't have that. And they lived in accordance with the rational, the commitment to the rational absolute. It's fine. This is what we need to do, and they did it. That's Kedusha. When a person lives his life and gratifies all of his emotions in their appropriate place and for their appropriate purpose, that's Kedusha. So that, I think, is the idea that Hashem expressed. To the contrary, because it's not just saying it's okay, it's tolerated, but it's more beloved, because that represents the highest level of perfection that man, given the fact that he's a creature of physical desires, that represents the highest level that he can attain. So it's more beloved. In general, religion has there's a dichotomy. And they can't work out the proper place of the sensual. It doesn't work. It's bad. Because for them, the Yetzer Hara is bad. And the Yetzer Hara is tov. It's like, good versus evil. Satan. So therefore, they can't figure out how to incorporate it into your relationship with Hashem. And Judaism, to the contrary, incorporates it. And maintains that there's nothing intrinsically what's evil about it. God created it. And God created it and has a purpose. So when man uses it and it's intelligently and controls it, it becomes a service of God. So that becomes holy. Well, what's holy? So that idea, I think, is something which makes sense. I have to give full credit to Moshe. I'm not going to attribute that idea, the other idea, which I've just sort of attributed to the other religion. I'm not going to say that that's the reason why Moshe didn't want it. You can't attribute such a reason to Moshe. I mean, he's the greatest prophet. He knew the entire Torah. So now, once we have this side of the coin, then we have to try to understand the position of Moshe.